world around us.
The financial information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing specific financial advice. You should contact a financial advisor to obtain specific financial advice. Lecture 2, Benjamin Graham and Value Investing.
Benjamin Graham is known as the father of value investing, and he pioneered a rigorous quantitative approach to security analysis. Value investing is the art of trying to buy an asset at a deep discount, like 50 cents on the dollar. As we'll see, his groundbreaking investment strategy had its roots in his own personal hardship. Graham started investing during the early 1900s. The landscape then was a whole lot different than it is today. For one thing, investing wasn't typically thought of as a respectable profession. It was viewed more like astrology or a game of chance, run by crooks and people with inside information. And using inside information was legal at the time. Before Congress created the Securities and Exchange Commission in 1934 to regulate the financial markets after the Great Depression, it was optional for firms to produce audited financial statements on a regular basis. It's even been said that Joe Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, was appointed as the first chairman of the SEC because he knew many of the tricks the scammers used to stack the deck in their favor. Many investors at the time traded on rumors or hot tips. Joe Kennedy once said he knew it was time to get out of the market when he received stock tips from a shoeshine boy. Other investors use an early form of technical analysis, making investment decisions based on stock price and volume changes. Back then, there were no computers, but there were stock ticker machines that produced quotes on thin strips of paper. Maybe you've seen photographs of a ticker tape parade after the World Series, or perhaps you were a fan of the 1960s TV show, The Addams Family. Gomez Addams, who played the debonair father in a ghoulish household, was often excited to read the ticker tape coming out of his home stock ticker machine. Before the days of Bloomberg terminals and Yahoo finance charts, the ticker tape listed all the information that many investors had with which to make an investment decision. And that was the stock symbol, price, change in price, and volume of shares traded. That's it. Benjamin Graham's contributions to security analysis are almost too numerous to mention, but one of his seminal insights was viewing stock as the ownership of a business. Back then, and even today, many investors view stock as little more than a vehicle to speculate. Graham was a successful money manager who taught at Columbia University in New York City, and who, with a fellow faculty member named David Dodd, wrote a book in 1934 called Security Analysis, which has since become known on Wall Street as the Bible of Value Investing. At 725 pages, it's almost the size of the Bible. Warren Buffett later called another book by Graham, The Intelligent Investor, which was published in 1949, the best book on investing ever written. It's a bit slimmer at 640 pages and a more investor-friendly read. The point is this. The difference between Graham's strategies and some of the investment techniques used by his peers and predecessors is like the contrast between Babe Ruth and the home run hitters who came before him. In 1920, Babe Ruth hit 54 home runs for the New York Yankees. Before Babe Ruth came onto the scene, the record for home runs in a single season was only half that, 27. In fact, most years prior to Ruth, the single season home run leader hit between 7 and 12. In this session, we'll provide some background on Ben Graham and his pioneering work on value investing. We'll also discuss examples of his strategy in action. It's not an exaggeration to say that Ben Graham changed the investing landscape forever. Benjamin Graham was born as Benjamin Grossbaum in London, England in 1894. He moved with his family to New York City when he was 1 year old. His father, Isaac, ran a successful retail business selling high-end dishes or chinaware and figurines. The family led a comfortable life on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. They were well off enough to afford servants. But that all changed when Graham was 9 years old and his father died. The business went downhill quickly, and Graham's mother, Dorothy, also known as Dora, was wiped out trading stocks during the crash of 1907. The Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Zweig, who produced a revised version of Graham's classic, The Intelligent Investor, cites a powerful story that helped shape Graham's character and ultimately his investment philosophy. He relates that Graham once cashed a check for his mother at a local bank and overheard someone say, "Is Dorothy Grossbaum good for $5? The family changed its name from Grossbaum to Graham after World War I due to the discrimination that was common against people of German and Jewish descent at the time. Graham was an excellent student, and he received a scholarship to Columbia University. After graduating second in his class in 1914 at the age of 20, he turned down a teaching position at the university since he felt he needed to earn more money in order to help support his family. Graham began his Wall Street career with the firm of Neuberger, Henderson, and Loeb. He quickly rose through the ranks and made partner at the age of 26. He left Neuberger in 1923 to set up his own partnership, which he ran by himself at first, and later with business partner Jerome Newman. The investment vehicles related to this business agreement became known as the Graham-Newman Partnerships. In 1928, he finally returned to Columbia to teach, and his 1934 book, Security Analysis, was created in large part from the lecture notes of this class. One of Graham's principles was that if you had the money and weren't willing to buy a company, then you shouldn't be willing to buy a share of its stock either. As he put it, every corporate security may be best viewed in the first instance as an ownership in, or claim against, a specific business enterprise. With that in mind, you certainly would be interested in the firm's financials. Graham focused on the balance sheet, which lists assets on the left-hand side and liabilities and net worth on the right. You'd probably also want to buy a business that has stood the test of time, at least in those days. For example, you might want to make sure the company has survived a couple of recessions. Or as Warren Buffett said, you only find out who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. You'd probably also like to buy a business that was selling at a discount to what you thought it was worth, just in case something went wrong, or if you miscalculated its value. Graham summarized these ideas into the concept margin of safety. He phrased it this way: to have a true investment, there must be present a true margin of safety. And a true margin of safety is one that can be demonstrated by figures, by persuasive reasoning, and by reference to a body of actual experience. It's not a mystery why Graham had such a strong focus on margin of safety. Like many people of his generation, he was scarred by his family's loss of wealth and by his own financial setbacks during the Great Depression. Between 1929 and 1932, his partnerships lost 70%. Graham focused on quantitative measures of value. He first looked at the value of existing assets, things like cash, inventory, and property. He did so by examining a target company's financial statements and also other resources around at the time, such as the Moody's Manual. Moody's Manual of Industrial and Miscellaneous Securities combined research and data on a bunch of firms, especially railroads. It had a fanatical following. Warren Buffett once said, People who want to relive their youth buy old Playboys. I buy old Moody's. Next, Graham looked at current earnings. Lastly, and only in rare circumstances, he considered future profits. And only in the core competence area of a firm with a sustainable competitive advantage. Graham was aware of growth stocks, but he thought they were too risky since they might blow up. For example, a lot of internet stocks like Webvan and CMGI went bankrupt or lost most of their value after the bubble popped. Back in Graham's day, many early stage car and computer companies also went bust, despite the overall tremendous growth in their industries. Graham thought that the odds of finding the next blockbuster stock, like an Apple, Google, or Microsoft in our time, was about as likely as winning the lottery. He said, "Of course, wonders can be accomplished with the right individual selections, but the average investor can no more accomplish this than to find money growing on trees." The concept of mean reversion is a major underpinning in the value investing philosophy. What do we mean by the phrase mean reversion in the context of stocks? It says past winners often become future losers, while past losers often become future winners. Graham himself said, "Over the long run, performance of both companies and share prices generally revert to the mean." What causes this 180-degree change? In a word, competition. If you're at a firm that's on top, everyone is gunning for you, trying to take a piece of your market share and profits. These top firms are often trading at high valuations, so when things go wrong, the stock has far to fall. On the other hand, if things are going poorly at a firm, it might have less competition, and you can often fix the problems. Investors probably don't expect much from these stocks. They've probably already been beaten down, so if things turn around, there may be a lot of upside. Former General Electric CEO Jack Welch, a legend in corporate America, put it this way: GE will be number one or number two in every industry it competes in. Otherwise, we'll try to fix it. If we can't fix it, we'll get out. So some underperforming businesses can be fixed, while others can be exited, removing the drag on performance. Graham was also early to recognize the role of market psychology in investing. Maybe you've chased a stock that had great past performance or sold stocks near market bottom. If so, psychology has probably gotten the best of you. Graham put it this way: the investor's chief problem, even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. Today, the field of investor psychology is known by academics and practitioners as behavioral finance. Some Nobel Prizes have been awarded to researchers in this field. Value investments often occur due to market psychology, with fear and greed moving prices away from their long run or equilibrium prices. Graham devised a widely cited analogy to explain market mood swings. He postulated a schizophrenic business partner that he called Mr. Market. Each day, Mr. Market offered what he was willing to pay for your share of the business, or at what price he would sell you additional shares. Sometimes Mr. Market was in a bad mood, and the price was far too low. Other times he'd be euphoric and offer a very high price. Occasionally, the price was in line with your estimate of the value of the business. Graham said you should forget trying to change Mr. Market's mood and forget figuring out what drives him. Just recognize that he is schizophrenic and try to buy low and sell high. The same strategy should apply to your investments. If you don't like that analogy of market behavior, Graham has another one that's also widely cited. He said the market is a pendulum that forever swings between unsustainable optimism, which makes stocks too expensive, and unjustified pessimism, which makes stocks too cheap. The intelligent investor is a realist who sells to optimists and buys from pessimists. So, According to Graham, stock prices deviate from their long-run fundamental values due to too much optimism or pessimism. Intelligent investors must have the temperament to buy when sentiment is bad and sell when sentiment is good. It sounds good in theory. In practice, many investors don't have the stomach to do this, since it involves going against the crowd. Graham used a number of value-oriented strategies to pick investments. One of his favorites was to find companies selling for less than their cash liquidation value. He called this deep value strategy net-net. Graham's net-net calculation started with the cash and cash equivalent item on a firm's balance sheet, and then added a conservative portion, let's say 75%, of accounts receivable and inventory. Then he subtracted all liabilities. He then compared this aggregate amount of cash and hard assets, let's say $100 million, for example, to the stock market value of the firm. If the company was selling in the stock market for less than $100 million, Graham would consider it a bargain under his net-net deep value approach. He estimated that his net-net strategy provided his partnerships with returns of about 20% a year, double the market's historical return. There were a lot of net-nets around during the Great Depression, but over time it became much harder to find companies trading for less than their net cash on hand. Occasionally these firms exist even in today's market, but they tend to be money-losing companies with questionable long-term prospects. The first investment that put Graham on the map was known as the Northern Pipeline Affair. It was a net-net type of investment, but it was also an early example of activist investing, a strategy later made famous by corporate raiders such as Carl Icahn and Bill Ackman. In 1911, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the breakup of John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil under a federal antitrust lawsuit brought by the Justice Department. As a result, Rockefeller's industrial empire was split into 34 separate companies. Northern Pipeline Company was one of Standard Oil's 34 sister companies. Its business involved transporting crude oil to a Standard Oil refinery. After the Supreme Court decision, Graham combed through the forms that energy firms filed with the Interstate Commerce Commission. Obviously, this sort of analysis requires a lot more work than following a hot tip or looking at a stock ticker tape. He found that Northern Pipeline had $95 a share in railroad bonds and other liquid assets. Yet, the stock was trading for only $65 a share. And it also paid a hefty 9% annual dividend yield. Back then, it wasn't uncommon for stocks to pay dividend yields higher than bond yields. Conventional wisdom up to the 1950s was that stocks are paid after bonds and are riskier. Therefore, they should pay higher yields. In 1926, Graham's partnership acquired roughly a 5% stake in Northern Pipeline, and he asked the company to distribute more cash to shareholders. Northern Pipeline's management wasn't pleased at being told what to do by Graham and actively avoided his requests. In 1928, after contacting other shareholders and requesting their help, Graham put together proxies, or voting power, equal to 38% of Northern Pipeline shares, and was able to get himself appointed to the firm's board of directors. Over time, he persuaded the company to pay out $70 a share in special or extra dividends. Coming in the midst of the Great Depression, it was a very attractive return for Graham and his partners. Geico, the car insurance company with the funny TV commercials, was Benjamin Graham's most famous investment. In case you wind up on the Jeopardy game show someday, Geico stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. Geico wasn't a net-net investment, but it had unique value, like its superior business model of selling car insurance. Graham purchased almost half of the company in 1948 for his investment partnerships at a 10% discount to its book value. Graham usually diversified widely, but in this instance, he put almost a quarter of his partnership's assets into this single investment. He felt very good about it, even though he tried to negotiate some provisions that would provide him with an out without suffering a large loss if things went bad. GEICO rode the wave of the post-World War II American automobile industry. Among its advantages was its clever business model of selling directly through the mail at discount prices. Drivers benefited from lower car insurance prices, while GEICO benefited from its lean infrastructure, avoiding the need to build a costly network of offices and salespeople. The Graham Newman Partnership's original $720,000 investment in 1948 would have been worth more than $500 million 25 years later. But Graham distributed the stock to his partners over time. Later, Warren Buffett bought all of GEICO for his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway. Graham made a distinction between the enterprising investor and the defensive investor. The difference wasn't based on risk tolerance, but rather the ability of the investor to put time and effort into the research process. His strategies for the enterprising investor required a lot more time and research, like his investment in Northern Pipeline, where he combed through a bunch of regulatory filings and waged a proxy battle against the firm. His strategies for the defensive investor were more passive in nature and involved buying larger, high-quality stocks at a discount and then holding them for the long term until they reach fair value. Over time, Graham became known more for his defensive strategies. For the defensive investor, Graham suggested seven factors in the selection of common stock. And unlike his net-net strategy, there will almost always be a fair amount of the firms that meet these seven criteria. So you could call it an evergreen strategy. And because so many people followed Graham's original strategy of buying deeply undervalued companies, alternative value strategies became necessary. The market always trends towards becoming more efficient, sweeping away the easy money opportunities. Here are the seven criteria. Number one is adequate size. Graham viewed adequate size in a target company as 100 million plus in sales in 1971 dollars, or about 600 million in sales today. That said, he viewed traditional government-regulated utilities as safer than industrial firms. So you can cut the adequate size threshold in half for utilities. Graham reasoned that larger firms are less likely to go out of business. They probably have the resources, scale, and experience to weather any storm. Number two is sufficiently strong financial condition. Graham defined sufficiently strong financial condition as current assets at least twice the size of current liabilities. He also thought that total liabilities should not be higher than working capital, or current assets minus current liabilities. This factor seems obvious, but it would screen out a large firm like Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers got its start in 1860, before the American Civil War, and it survived the Great Depression, the crash of 87, and countless other financial panics. But it went bankrupt in 2008 during the financial markets crisis because other big banks cut off its credit and its liquidity evaporated. Number three is earnings stability. Graham defined earnings stability as positive earnings for at least 10 consecutive years. This rule eliminates many cyclical firms and, by definition, firms that haven't been around for 10 years or more. Number four is a strong dividend record, and preferably 20 years or more of uninterrupted dividends. This rule eliminates most growth stocks since the vast majority of them don't pay dividends. Number five is organic earnings growth of at least 33% over the past 10 years. This is not a huge hurdle since U.S. GDP historically grew about 3% a year. But it does eliminate businesses that are stagnant or shrinking, even if they pay dividends or generate a lot of cash. Number six is a moderate price-to-earnings ratio. Graham defined this by saying that the current price of the stock should not be more than 15 times its average earnings over the past 3 years. This number makes sense to many investors since the long-term PE ratio for U.S. stocks is about 15. And finally, number seven, a moderate ratio of price to assets. Graham defined a moderate price to assets ratio as a firm trading for less than 1.5 times its book value. Book value is also known as accounting net worth. It's equal to all of the firm's assets minus all of its liabilities. The factor of less than 1.5 times book value also rules out most growth stocks since they often trade at high multiples of price to book. So Graham's evergreen strategy for value stocks can be summarized as adequate size, strong financial condition, earnings stability, a strong dividend record, earnings growth of at least 33% over the past 10 years, a moderate PE ratio, and moderate price to assets. In his later years, Graham suggested another simple value formula. He suggested creating a portfolio of at least 30 stocks with PE ratios below 10 and debt to equity ratios under 50%. Hold each stock until it returns 50%, and if it doesn't achieve a 50% return, sell it after 2 years, no matter what. Graham back-tested this formula and found it to earn about 15% a year over the previous half century. A more recent study encompassing the 1976 to 2011 period found that the strategy held up, returning almost 18% a year, including capital gains and dividends, against an 11% total return for the Standard & Poor's 500 index. I think value investing works because of the combination of market competition and investor psychology. Competition results in top firms falling back down to earth, and with underperforming firms fixing themselves, basically mean reversion. The psychology aspect is the hardest part to stick to. If money managers buy the leading firms of the day, say Apple, Starbucks, and the like, it's hard to get fired, at least when the going is good. The Wall Street expression is, you can shake hands on the way down. Another one is that it's warm in the herd. In contrast, if value managers stick their necks out and buy a stock with problems and they blow up, the manager looks really stupid and it's more likely to get fired. And that is why I think the advantages of value investing will endure. So to wrap this up, Benjamin Graham made seminal contributions to measuring value, viewing stocks as the ownership of a business, and investing with a margin of safety. He made clear the distinction between speculation and investment. He defined it this way. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Many of the most successful investors of the 20th and early 21st centuries were hugely influenced by his work, including Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and other legends such as John Templeton, Peter Lynch, Mario Gabelli, Charles Brandis, and Joel Greenblatt. In 1937, Graham became one of the founders of the New York Society of Security Analysts. It's the largest group of security analysts in the world and did a lot to make security analysis a respected profession. The New York and other societies like it created what we know of today as the CFA Institute, which administers the Chartered Financial Analyst, or CFA, program. Having a CFA charter is viewed as the gold standard credential for anyone who wants to become an investment analyst or money manager.